You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Many Americans have never felt more isolated than they do right now. Travel restrictions have made it difficult to visit our loved ones. Besides, who wants to brave a crowded airport and a confined airplane cabin just to see friends and family? In many counties, strict social distancing rules still remain in place, confining us to our homes and discouraging in-person interactions. And all of the usual public events that bring together communities in the summer, from county fairs to music festivals, have been banned. As a result, the United States is facing a loneliness crisis. But my guest today says that loneliness was already becoming a mental health epidemic long before the quarantine. He's former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, and he writes about it in a new book titled Together, The Healing Power of Human Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World. And today, Dr. Murthy joins me on the podcast where he discusses the many mental and physical impacts of feeling lonely and reveals that chronic loneliness is just as bad for you as smoking or obesity. He opens up about his own bouts of loneliness at times during his life, how he came to realize that it's a much larger problem than he ever realized, and he even says he's spoken to a number of members of Congress who struggle with it as well. He shares the difference between someone who is genuinely lonely versus someone who enjoys being alone, how loneliness can often disguise itself as other health problems, and how loneliness once served as an evolutionary function but might be holding us back in modern society. Vivek also weighs in on the president's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, shares insights from when he dealt with the Ebola and Zika outbreaks as Surgeon General, and offers advice for how to improve the quality of our online and socially distanced interactions during quarantine. Coming up with Dr. Vivek Murthy in just a moment. Dr. Vivek Murthy served as the 19th Surgeon General of the United States, appointed by President Barack Obama. During his tenure, Dr. Murthy launched the Turn the Tide campaign, catalyzing a movement among health professionals to address the nation's opioid crisis, and he issued the first Surgeon General's report on alcohol, drugs, and health, calling for expanded access to prevention and treatment, and for recognizing addiction as a chronic illness rather than a character flaw. He's also been a leader in addressing what he calls America's loneliness epidemic, and he writes about it in a new book, Together, The Healing Power of Human Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World. Dr. Vivek Murthy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Ben. It's good to be with you.
Well, I have to say, I really found your book very enlightening. I feel like we're only beginning to recognize just how many people in this country suffer from chronic loneliness, but it is something that's coming up a lot in my conversations with people about health more and more these days. When did you first become aware that the U.S. is in the middle of a loneliness crisis?
Well, Ben, I first realized there was something deeper going on that was affecting people around the country when I was Surgeon General. And it was during that time, the very beginning of my tenure, that I embarked on this listening tour where I would go to small towns and big cities across America asking people simple questions like, how can I help? And what's on your mind when it comes to your health? And I would sit back and listen, and I heard some extraordinary things, some things that didn't surprise me, although they were really important for me to hear, like about how devastating the opioid epidemic had been to families. I heard stories about violence in communities. I heard from parents who were worried about their children using vaping devices and weren't sure how to address that. I heard from so many people who wondered if technology was ultimately helping their social lives or leaving them more disconnected. But what I realized was that behind so many of these stories were these unspoken threads of loneliness. And people wouldn't come up to me and say, "Hi, I'm Ben, I'm lonely," or "I'm Vivek, I'm lonely." But they would say things like, "I feel I have to carry this entire burden on my own." Or, "I feel if I disappear tomorrow, no one would even notice." Or, "I feel invisible." And I was hearing this from college students, from elderly folks. I was hearing this from parents, from people in remote fishing villages in Alaska, and from members of Congress who would confide this in hushed tones behind closed doors.
Really? Members of Congress? I guess I could see that. I mean, congressmen aren't exactly treated like everyone else, and every interaction they have with a person is probably a complaint or an ask. Rarely is anyone ever happy with you. You can't really vent about your problems. What kind of things did you hear from them?
Yes. In fact, I remember one member of Congress in particular that I was meeting with in his office, and it was just me and him at the time. There's no staff around. And he confided that he had heard me talk about loneliness and was happy that I was addressing it, but asked at some point, could I do something about the struggles with loneliness and emotional well-being among members of Congress? Because he said that many of them would have to move to D.C. away from their families. They would be constantly under the microscope. They would get criticized if they even tried to have lunch or dinner with a member of the opposite party. And it became an extremely lonely experience for them, where they felt that there were very few places where they could be themselves. He wasn't looking for sympathy per se. He certainly recognized that members of Congress are certainly privileged compared to most people in the country. But a point I took away from him and from the stories of so many others that I heard around the country was that loneliness is far more common than I had thought.
Right. And even before you realized that this was a national crisis, you admit that you yourself have battled with loneliness at various points in your life. Tell us about that.
My own experiences of loneliness as a child, which were deep and painful during my time in elementary school and which continued at various points during adulthood. But it also reminded me of my experiences as a doctor, taking care of so many patients who came into the hospital alone. And even at critical moments, when we had to give them a difficult diagnosis or make a really tough decision on treatment, there was nobody there to be with them, to help them make those tough choices. They were all by themselves.
And of course, not a lot of people want to admit that they're lonely because we have a bit of a stigma against it. Have you found that others who suffer from this are maybe finding it comforting and encouraging to hear a successful former Surgeon General of the United States open up about his own bouts with this issue?
You know, I do hope that it's helpful, and I hope that we can all start sharing more of our stories when it comes to loneliness. Because the truth is that when I was a child, I never spoke about these things, even though I was struggling with loneliness. And I didn't talk to my parents about it or anyone else because I was ashamed. I thought that somehow being lonely meant that I was broken, that I wasn't likable, and I certainly didn't want to feel that way. But what we know now, and what I know now that I wished I had known before, is that loneliness is not a disease or evidence that you are broken. Loneliness is, in fact, a natural signal, like hunger or thirst, that our body sends to us when we are lacking something that we need for our survival, and in this case, so it's social connection. And when we respond to that need by calling a friend or visiting a loved one, then the loneliness may subside, just as hunger, thirst subside when we get food or water. But if it persists for a long time, that's when loneliness could start to have serious effects on us, impacting our mental health as well as our physical health.
Yeah, actually, you made this rather astonishing and perhaps controversial statement when you said that loneliness is worse for us than smoking or obesity. What are the statistics to back that up, Vivek?
It's from a meta-analysis that was done at Brigham Young University by Julianne Holt Lunstead. Research that was done after a growing body of evidence was showing that loneliness seemed to be associated with poor health outcomes. And what Julianne found in her work was that loneliness was associated with a reduction in lifespan.
Wow.
And was in fact also associated with an increased risk of premature death. And when you looked at the degree to which the lifespan was shortened in people who struggled with loneliness, it was similar to the mortality impact of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. It was greater than the mortality impact of obesity and sedentary living.
It also seems particularly difficult to diagnose and treat because loneliness sometimes disguises itself in so many other ways as depression or anxiety, overeating, addiction, while the root cause is far more elusive. How do we go about treating a health crisis that doesn't always show itself in the most obvious ways?
I tend to avoid thinking about it as an illness, the way we might think about diabetes or high blood pressure, because I think that loneliness is more complicated than that. I think it is a normal state of being that can have adverse effects when it stays around for a long time, when we experience it for prolonged periods of time. And so in the same way that I wouldn't consider hunger a disease or thirst a disease, I wouldn't consider loneliness a disease. But I do think what's important is that we understand, one, how to respond to it effectively, and two, what to do when it persists for a long period of time. And I say this because one of the things that has struck me, and I say this despite my medical training, is that I do think sometimes we can have a tendency to over-medicalize things in our culture.
Sure.
And there's some cases where that's the right thing to do. There are other cases where that can actually take the issue that we're talking about and almost remove our agency from it.
Right. And not everyone who just kind of enjoys doing their own thing is lonely. What is the difference between someone who is maybe a bit of a loner or enjoys solitude versus someone who genuinely suffers from loneliness?
That's a great question. And it brings up the larger question of definitions. So loneliness is a subjective state, and it's in contrast to an objective term like isolation, which is more a description of the number of people we have around us. But loneliness is really about how we feel about those connections. So if we are a freshman in college, surrounded by hundreds, if not thousands, of new students, but we don't know any of them and don't feel comfortable showing up as who we are, then that can become a very lonely experience very quickly. What's also relevant here is that being a college student on campus or a new person joining a company, you might find that you're thrown into an environment that has very extroverted expectations. So if you're in orientation week in college, there are likely mixers and parties and other events that you can go to. But what if you're an introvert and you actually don't enjoy socializing as much in large group settings, if it drains you and you prefer, in fact, one-on-one conversations or small groups, or to stay home because you need time for solitude to replenish your energy? I'm an introvert. And what that means for me is that I need more solitude, perhaps, than my extroverted friends. And if I don't do a good job of creating time for solitude, which is, again, solitude not being the same thing as loneliness. Solitude is time we seek out. It's time that can be joyful, that can be peaceful, that can be replenishing. And it's time, when I spend time in solitude, I feel more centered and grounded. Because as one of my friends told me, here's how to understand the difference between introverts and extroverts. She said, an extrovert starts out the day with an empty basket, and every person they meet along the way gives them an apple, and they put that in the basket. And by the end of the day, after all these interactions, their basket is full and they feel great. An introvert starts the day with a basket full of apples, and every person they meet, they give an apple away to. And by the end of the day, after all those interactions, their basket is empty and they are energetically depleted. And they need to replenish.
Interesting. So solitude and having time for, say, meditation actually makes our interactions with people in person better.
It does, because what matters so much in our interactions with others is where we're coming from. Are we grounded in that moment, or are we frazzled? Are we feeling calm and confident, or are we anxious and worried? Even extroverts need moments of solitude.
Sure.
Having solitude in your life doesn't mean, Ben, that all of us need to go on a 7-day silent retreat once a month, although that may serve you well, and I certainly would love to do that at some point. But solitude can just be 5 minutes that we spend sitting on our front porch, feeling the breeze against our face. It can be a few minutes that we spend remembering a few things to be grateful for, or a few minutes meditating or praying or simply taking a walk through nature or curling up with a good book. There are many ways to experience solitude, but we all need some of it. And what worries me, Ben, in the modern world is that our time for solitude has evaporated as we've become busier and busier, and as our smartphones have filled in all the spare moments in our life. But I also worry that we've become uncomfortable with solitude, and that when we're alone with our thoughts, that it makes us feel uncomfortable. We don't know what to do with that. And we can very quickly pick up our phone, look at the news or read something on social media and feel the comfort and certainty that comes from those things and not having to confront our own thoughts. But comfort with being alone, developing and protecting time for solitude, these are essential in everyone's life.
Right. And in the same sense, how much of this problem can be attributed to the fact that we are constantly distracted by texts, our Instagram feeds, work emails, when we're supposedly spending quality time with our kids or having dinner with a spouse or a friend? Is the lack of presence in our interactions a factor in why so many people feel maybe unheard, unnoticed, unimportant, and alone?
Well, Ben, you're hitting on something that's really important, which is I do think that the way in which we're using technology these days is having a dilutive effect on our relationships. So if I'm talking to a good friend on the phone, but I'm also refreshing my social media feed and checking my inbox and Googling a question that popped into my head while I'm checking the score and the game that's on the TV in the background and occasionally looking at the news, this is a very distracted conversation I'm having. But it's actually not unusual for people to be doing that. And I have done this too. I'm not proud to say it, but I have done this too, because we convince ourselves we can multitask. But
sure.
The science is very clear that we cannot. What we do when we think we're multitasking is we actually rapidly task switch, which means when we're paying attention to our inbox, we're not actually fully listening to the person that we're talking to. So tech can have that effect on diluting the quality of our interactions. It can also edge out our in-person interactions as we spend more and more time in front of screens and on social media. But we've got to be mindful of how technology is impacting our relationships, and we have to draw boundaries around it so that we have sacred spaces in our lives where we are just focused on another human being, where we are giving them the gift of our full attention. And when we do that, we'll find that 5 minutes of deep, open, fully present conversation can be more powerful than a half hour of distracted conversation.
Yes, technology is great in many ways, but we've always had this problem of keeping up with the Joneses, but now it's keeping up with the Joneses on steroids. It's not just keeping up with the Joneses, it's keeping up with everyone on our Facebook feed, and in some cases, people we've never even physically met, people we don't even know.
That's exactly right. And, you know, on the face of it, it seems almost unbelievable that we would, let's say, care so much about what somebody was doing thousands and thousands of miles away, who we don't even know and probably will never meet, but they seem to have a nicer car than us, or they seem to have a fancier house than us, or they seem to be more popular than us. But you're looking at people's idealized versions of their life. You're looking at their best moments, and inevitably you compare them to your average moments, and you always come up short. And I worry particularly for young people who are receiving these messages through social media and through larger channels that they're not good looking enough, they're not smart enough, they're not thin enough, they're not popular enough. And as that erodes their sense of self and their self-confidence, it makes it harder for them to have meaningful interactions with others. But it doesn't have to be this way. See, technology at the end of the day is not evil. Technology is a tool. And it is how we use it that determines whether or not it strengthens or weakens our connections.
And another interesting thing that comes up in your book is how we're really genetically hardwired to experience loneliness. We evolved into a tribal species because, of course, there's strength in numbers. But has that survival mechanism in us perhaps turned into something that now does us more harm than good?
Social connection truly is foundational. But what is so interesting about it is it's not new. You know, thousands of years ago when we were hunter-gatherers wandering the tundra, it was our trusted relationships that increased our chances of survival. When we had groups that we were a part of, we could share our food and reduce the likelihood that we'd starve from an insufficient food supply. We could also take turns watching around the fire at night to make sure the group was protected from predators. We could help each other out with childcare and other home responsibilities to make life a bit more easier and sustainable. And when we were separated from the group, that automatically meant that our chances of survival dropped. And our body knew that, and it induced a stress state in our body because we were under threat, more likely to be pursued by predators, for example. We had to be prepared to fight or to flee. Now, that stress state is beneficial in the short term, in the same way that loneliness today might motivate us to call a good friend or visit a family member. But the problem is when loneliness persists for a long period of time, and even though we're no longer hunter-gatherers men, our nervous systems are very similar to how they were thousands of years ago, and we experience the same stress today when we're separated from family and friends and when we feel lonely. And over time, that chronic stress can lead to greater inflammation in our body and increase our risk of heart disease and other chronic illnesses.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Are you ready to set a new standard of success for yourself? As your career grows, you want to do more, strive more. Your drive and determination have helped you get to where you are today, and at Capella University, they want to help you do even more. They've created flexible doctoral programs that work with your schedule and can help you put your passion into action. Wondering where to start, what it's like to be a doctoral student, or what it takes to find success with online learning? Capella has designed online degree programs to help you raise your own bar and gain the skills you need to get where you want in your career. Their courses, curriculum, and learning formats are all created with flexibility in mind to fit your life and your schedule. Learn more about the experience and skills that Capella can help you build while earning your doctoral degree. When you're ready to explore next steps, visit capella.edu/doctoraljourney. That's capella.edu/doctoraljourney. A while back, I talked with Senator Ben Sasse about political polarization, and I was shocked at how often loneliness crept into that conversation. Do you think that our politics and polarization are contributing to our sense of isolation, or might it even be a vicious cycle where the two are just feeding off of each other?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I do think this is deeply tied together, the issues of loneliness and political polarization. We've evolved to seek out our tribe, and the question that we have to ask ourselves in the modern age is, who constitutes our tribe? You know, thousands of years ago, it was people who looked like us and came from a similar background. But the world in which we live in now, a world that is more pluralistic, that is more inclusive, requires us to expand our definition of what could constitute a tribe. The United States, in many ways, was built upon that premise. The premise that our tribe is not defined by the countries that we came from or the language that we speak. It was defined by our desire to seek out freedom, to work for it, and to protect it. That was a radical idea for so many reasons, because it ran counter to thousands of years of evolution where people were primarily getting together with people who shared very similar backgrounds and experiences, and that was their tribe.
Okay, so then how do we get back to that sense of shared values and purpose in this country?
What we are called to do in the modern age now in the United States, and I think increasingly in countries around the world, is to be more explicit and clear about what constitutes our tribe to define that not by our skin color, our language, or our cultural heritage, but by our values, by our shared experience and our shared outlook for the future. We all care about the welfare of our children, and we want a safer world for them. We want our children to have opportunity. We don't want our children to struggle in poverty. They alone constitute just a few of the core values that can serve as a point of connection. That's where we have to focus. That's how we have to build a relationship. And if we build a relationship, that becomes our foundation of dialogue. That's how we begin to address political polarization in the U.S. and around the world.
Vivek, I have to ask you about COVID-19, and inevitably some of this will dovetail with our conversation about loneliness. First off, do you think that the Trump administration has done enough and done enough early enough to combat the coronavirus?
Well, let me say from the outset, Ben, that having been a part of two major responses when I was in government, the Ebola response and the Zika response, I know that it is very difficult to be learning about something new while you're trying to take action to address it. And inevitably, in Republican and Democratic administrations, there are stumbles. But what matters is how you react to those stumbles. Do you learn from the mistakes that you made? Do you communicate openly and honestly with the public about those so that you can build trust? And what I worry about is that we were both late to the response here with COVID-19 in the U.S., but we also continue to struggle when it comes to pulling out the stops to make sure that we are expanding the core capacities that we need, which include testing, the ability to do contact tracing, the ability to ensure that our hospital systems have the protective equipment and capacity to surge if we have a second wave. The people in America have made extraordinary sacrifices to stay home, to turn their lives upside down. In many cases, they've lost their jobs. And they've done this because we told them we needed to buy time for our hospital systems not to be overrun, for us to build testing and tracing capacity to be prepared. And the question is, are we doing right by people who have made those sacrifices? Are we making use of that time to prepare? I don't think we're doing enough now, and that is what worries me.
Well, Vivek, I want to go back to something that you touched on a moment ago, which is the importance of truth and the public trust in dealing with a crisis like COVID-19. When you were in the Obama administration dealing with the Zika and Ebola epidemics, how important were things like truth and the public trust to the overall success of the effort?
You know, in moments like this, and what we've seen in past administrations, is that people pull together in times of emergency. We have to communicate consistently and with one voice. That doesn't mean that we never change our mind, but if we get new data and it tells us we need to change course, that we explain that to the public. We help bring them along our process of decision-making. I worry that we're not doing a good job here as a country when it comes to delivering on these core benchmarks that we have to meet to open safely and to address a second wave. And we're sowing confusion in the country as we have allowed this response to become politicized. A simple example, the CDC issued guidance saying that we should be wearing masks in public, yet somehow that public health guidance has become politicized, and now wearing a mask seems to be a political statement of which side of the aisle you're on.
Right.
That is truly unfortunate, because it is when public health becomes politicized, people suffer and we lose more lives. We've already seen that happen. I worry that many of the deaths that we're seeing now in the country, I do think could have been avoided if we had an earlier and more effective and more unified response.
And in some sense, this is just an extension of an alarming trend that we've seen over the past few years, which is the politicization of science. Even now, I'm seeing a significant number of people on my social media, people I know, making this whole "the cure is worse than the disease" argument against the quarantine, and they point to the mental health impact of physical isolation in particular. Do you think that there is a significant population for whom the resulting loneliness and depression might actually be more dangerous to their health than the potential of catching the virus?
Well, everyone in the population exists on a spectrum of risk. There's some people for whom, even if they catch this virus, if they have COVID-19, the effects will be minimal to none. But yes, they may suffer serious consequences from losing their job or from the depression and anxiety and loneliness that come from COVID-19, but there are plenty of people for whom the opposite is true, where they are at high risk of having complications or dying if they get COVID-19. And that would be a far worse outcome than the economic challenges and the mental health challenges that they may face having to stay at home. The truth is, though, saying that you have to choose between one or another is a false choice that we've been forced into here. The reality is that if we do our job as a country, if our government steps up to ensure we have the pieces in place to open up safely, which it has the power to do by expanding testing dramatically, by getting the contact tracing capability in place that we need in all 50 states, if they do that, we can open up earlier. We are, in fact, delaying our opening up because we're failing to get ready as a country. We're making opening up safe. And by what we're forcing people to do is have to make this choice. There is a third option, which is we can choose both to protect the economy and our health, but it requires us moving fast. And there are times, Ben, when we function as 50 states and we all do our own thing. But there are times when we have to be one nation. This is when you need the federal government to step up. And in this case, they need to take over the production and distribution of tests to make sure we have not only enough, but that it's distributed well and that anyone who needs it can get tested, which is not the case now. They need to take over when it comes to ensuring that we have a trained core of contact tracers. And so they need to support states in that effort. We have a small fraction right now of the people that we need in order to trace contacts. And what that means is that if we detect a new infection, we don't have enough resources to make sure we can, in a sense, throw a net over that infection and contain it, which means it will continue to spread in the community. But these are avoidable problems. This is where leadership from government is so critical.
And bringing it back to loneliness, it's been kind of interesting and fun to see how people are getting creative about finding workarounds to this quarantine, such as happy hours on Zoom, FaceTiming. But still, none of this really takes place of normal social experiences where you can hug, shake hands, share the same space. Having a herky-jerky conversation on Zoom or Skype where you're talking over each other or there's a delay because of Wi-Fi being really slow doesn't quite cut it. I wonder, are there things that we can do to improve the quality of these virtual and socially distanced interactions through this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the truth is, Ben, there is really no full substitute for being in person. That's true, because that's how we've interacted for thousands of years. That's what our bodies and our nervous systems are used to responding to. But with that said, I do think that we can use technology in particular ways that can help keep our connections alive and, in fact, can actually deepen our connections from where they were before the pandemic. So, for example, if we make it a point to put some time aside each day, could just be 15 minutes, to spend with people we love, whether that's video conferencing with them or speaking to them on the phone, that can serve as a lifeline for us. And even though that's only a few minutes a day, it can leave us feeling more deeply connected. The second thing we can do is to focus on the quality of time that we have with the people we're speaking with. Mm-hmm. And that means putting away distraction when we're speaking with them. You know, if you've had this experience of being deeply listened to, of having somebody who's fully present when you're talking to them, you know that 5 minutes of conversation like that is so powerful.
Sure.
And we can achieve that right now without spending a single additional minute with somebody simply by giving them our full attention. I would consider two last things, which is one, the power of solitude. I had a professor in medical school, was an extraordinarily busy professor. She was a mom to two wonderful boys. She taught medical students. She took care of patients. She helped run the medical school. She was incredibly busy. But what she did is, recognizing the need for solitude, but not having the time to spend an hour meditating each day, she would use the 20 seconds that she had while she was washing her hands before she saw a patient. She would just think about the things she had to be grateful for that day. And then she would walk into that room after those 20 seconds, feeling more at peace and more able to be herself than she had been before. That's the power of what solitude can do for us. And keep this in mind as well. Perhaps one of the most powerful antidotes to loneliness, one of the greatest sources of connection that we can find, is service. And what service does is it shifts the focus from us to someone else in the context of a positive interaction. It also reminds us that we have value to bring to the world. There are many people around us who are struggling, and there are many opportunities to serve them. These are simple ways that we can strengthen and deepen our connection in this time of the pandemic. And if we do this, if we use this moment to refocus on our relationships, to recommit to making people a priority in our lives, then I think, as painful as this time is, that we can come out of this pandemic more deeply connected and more resilient than before the pandemic began.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I want to ask you, what about our kids? So many parents are now their children's sole source of companionship, and there's certainly nothing normal about not going to school, not having extracurricular activities like Little League and summer camp, playdates with friends. And I seriously wonder how this quarantine is affecting young people's emotional development. What kind of advice would you give to parents about how to deal with that, and maybe what kind of signs to look for that their kids might be suffering from loneliness?
Explaining to our kids what's happening during this pandemic can be tricky depending on how old they are. And it's tricky also because we don't know all the answers in terms of when this is all going to end either. And so this is not easy, but a couple of things I think are worth keeping in mind here. One is that is to recognize that this is a stressful time for all of us, adults and kids. And stress manifests in different ways in people's lives and in their bodies. For some people, stress may look like increased irritability and anger. In other people, it may look like depression or like withdrawal. It may show up as sleep disturbances or difficulty focusing during teaching. I would keep an eye out for patterns like that, for disruptions in how a child normally behaves, in how they learn, in how they socialize. And what I would also emphasize is that this is a time where we also may have an unexpected opportunity to spend quality time with our children in a way that we weren't perhaps able to before. And so I'm finding in this time, while I'm, like many parents, trying to figure out how to do work calls and potty train our 2-year-old and make sure our 3-year-old is eating and do all of that, that I do feel stressed and strained at times. But I'm realizing that just taking 5 minutes to horse around with the kids, to give them piggyback rides around the house, but it makes a real difference in how I feel as well as in how they feel. You know, lastly, let's just keep this in mind. Our kids learn so much from watching how we react to circumstances. So there are many ways I think we can strengthen our bonds with family and role model for our children how to deal with the stress of this moment, recognizing that this is a stressful moment for all of us. This is a type of trauma that we're going through.
Well, before we go, do you think that perhaps if there's a silver lining to this horrible pandemic, that we're starting to realize again the importance of the people in our lives and having meaningful social experiences with those people? Maybe once it's all said and done, might we finally put down our phones and maybe even enjoy a renaissance of social connection?
When I finished writing this book, what became clear to me is that the opposite of loneliness is actually love. And that's what the book is ultimately about. And if we focus on building a people-centered life, and we will make it possible to build a people-centered world. So that is my hope coming out of all of this, is that we can move forward with a simple credo: put people first. That's how I want to approach my life. It's what I'd love to see us use as a force for guiding how we design society and how we emerge from this pandemic.
Well, that's a beautiful thought for us to end on. Again, the book is called Together, The Healing Power of Human Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World. Dr. Vivek Murthy, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you so much, Ben. I really enjoyed this time together.
Thanks again to Dr. Vivek Murthy for coming on the show. Order his new book, Together, The Healing Power of Human Connection in a Sometimes Lonely World, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And follow him at vivekmurthy.com or on Twitter at @Vivek_Murthy. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.